This is the No Dhamma Podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this morning I'm joined by Abe Asphal, Global Leader of Quantum Education at IBMQ and QuizKit Developer Advocate. Thank you very much for taking time out of your morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Brian.
To start off, can you tell me a little bit about yourself, please?
Sure. So you've already mentioned that I work at IBM, so I'm involved in quantum computing research. One of the biggest roles that I'm involved in is making sure that people learn how to use quantum computers and are enabled to contribute to the field. It's very early days in the field today, so it's exciting to see communities building around the field.
Can you tell me a little bit more about what it means to be a leader of education and a developer advocate?
Sure. So let me give you a little bit of background. My undergraduate studies, I focused on electrical engineering and did some computer science courses. And immediately as I was about to graduate, my advisor gave me a book on Feynman's lectures on computation. And that book showed me how I can combine different fields, whether it's physics, mathematics, and computer science all together, to come together and contribute in this field of quantum computing. So the idea is, if you are not decisive about the coursework that you pick, this is a great field to be in because it's a nice mix of physics, electrical engineering, computer science, and so on. So having read this book, I was excited and went to graduate school and studied quantum computing. So I did experimental quantum computing work. And roughly in the middle of my graduate studies in 2016, so just to give you an idea, in graduate school, my day-to-day work was going to a clean room, fabricating small chips, building components of a quantum computer, testing them, cooling them down in a fridge, and so on. And roughly in 2016, I remember hearing the news that IBM put a quantum computer available on, made a quantum computer available on the cloud. So think about what that means as a graduate student who's trying to build these components and do these experiments myself, learning that a quantum computer is available on the cloud. So now the field is not just people who have lab access, but anyone with internet access can now access a quantum computer and run things on it. That's only 3 years ago. So as complicated as this field sounds, it's only 3 years ago that we've had access to a quantum computer. And that means even when I was learning about quantum algorithms and quantum computers in general, I used textbooks that did not have any lab components to them because I did not have a quantum computer to program things on. So to answer your question, as an education lead, what I'm trying to do is make sure that now that we have quantum computers available, students all over the world who are learning quantum computing can have access to these quantum computers and incorporate them into their coursework. So supplementing traditional quantum algorithms courses with materials that allow students to try their hand at programming a real quantum computer.
We have covered, or rather, I have covered a lot about quantum in this podcast, and in particular episodes 82 and 103 with Jay Gambetta from IBM. But can you briefly give a quick overview of what quantum is and why it's different?
Sure. So think about how we're building computers today. We're building computers based on logics of zeros and ones, and we're building them using transistors, right? So at the end of the day, we're building things out of transistors that are shrinking in size. And as they shrink and get smaller and smaller, at some point you start reaching fundamental limitations of physics in how you design these transistors. In particular, as you get closer to the atomic scale, it's not the traditional rules that we've been using to build these quantum computers that are in play, but quantum mechanics starts to come into play. And what this means is now you have two options, right? When you start seeing effects in these devices that you wouldn't expect because quantum mechanics is at play, you have two options. One is to try to defeat that physics. And there's only so much of that you can do. You're getting very close to the atomic scale. The other way is to completely re-envision the computer and to try to integrate these quantum effects from the ground up and to build a computer that takes advantage of these quantum effects. And once you start doing that, people have found algorithms that show significant speed ups compared to what a classical computer, which is the one that I mentioned we're building on today. So people have shown that you can make algorithms that take advantage of these quantum effects instead of trying to get around them. So a quantum computer, to answer your question, is something that builds fundamentally from the ground up on the principles of quantum mechanics and takes advantage of quantum mechanical effects. I should clarify, even the transistors that you're using in your computer today, at the fundamental level, still take advantage of quantum mechanics. But at the end of the day, we discretize the results out of these transistors and turn them into zeros and ones. Here, we're re-envisioning the computer to have to take full advantage of quantum effects at play.
So I have made a whole podcast on QuizKit with Jay, but can you give a quick overview of what that is too?
Right. So quantum computation is fundamentally re-envisioning the way we do computation. So to give you an idea of what that means, today's computers, the laptop that I'm using right now to talk to you, are built out of transistors. Fundamentally, these transistors take advantage of quantum mechanics, but at the end of the day, we're turning their operations into zeros and ones. We're taking the outputs of this transistor logic and looking at it in terms of zeros and ones, ons and offs. The way we've been making computers more and more powerful is by making these transistors smaller and smaller and packing more of them on the same chip. And at the end of the day, when you keep shrinking components, you start reaching a fundamental limit where you're now at the atomic scale and quantum mechanics is at play. When you reach this limit, you now have two design options. One option is to ask yourself, how do I get around quantum mechanics and try to sort of sidestep the issue here? You can do that, but that can only take you so far. So really the second step is to say, all right, so instead of trying to get around quantum mechanics, why don't I build a computer that takes advantage of quantum mechanics and integrates quantum mechanics from scratch, from the ground up, to build an entire computing system? So that requires understanding what information means from a quantum perspective. That requires understanding what computation means from a quantum perspective. And so at the end of the day, quantum computing is a field where we're trying to re-envision computing from the ground up, taking advantage of quantum effects.
And the QuizKit is something that I can download and start playing with?
Right. So let's forget the details of a quantum computer right now and just tell you there's one. Since 2016, IBM has put a quantum computer on the cloud. And once I tell you there's a quantum computer, the next question is, how do you program it? How do you interact with it? And QuizKit is QuizKit stands for Quantum Information Science Kit. It's open source software that allows you to program these quantum computers. So the idea here is, because it's open source and because this field is so young, there are many contributors to it, not just IBM. And so you have contributors and experts from all over the world building this software.
On the topic of QuizKit, you've published a book recently. Can you tell me about that, please?
Sure. So if I asked you to visit the IBM lab today and you looked at the people working on quantum computing, what you'll find is a large number of people who have PhDs in physics or some field of engineering who have been using their skills to contribute to the field. What we're trying to do here is build a community, not just at the PhD level, but integrate quantum computing into undergraduate coursework. And really, to do this, you need to understand what undergraduate students have learned in their undergraduate courses and to try to integrate quantum computing wherever it's relevant. So from this perspective, any undergraduate student who has taken a course on linear algebra, so knows how to multiply matrices, for example, and knows how to program a traditional using Python, is ready to take on quantum computing. So the textbook that we've published is called Learn Quantum Computation Using QuizKit. Again, this textbook, following the software itself that it's trying to teach, is open source, which means we have chapters in the textbook coming from professors who have used some of this material in their coursework. And really what we're trying to do is show students who are learning quantum computing how they can program quantum computers using QuizKit. So maybe to give you a clear picture of this, if you have a chemistry class in college, typically the structure is you have the classwork and you have the lab work. If you have a programming class, you typically have a computer science lectures and you have programming sessions. For quantum computing, it's very recently that the lab aspect of it became possible. So we're trying to make it possible by using this textbook. So we're making this textbook a supplement for quantum computing courses.
A textbook is also sort of, an example that this has become quite practical and available to people. And for the rest of the podcast, we're going to be talking about maybe some of the industry uses, commercial uses. Where are we now with regard to quantum out of the lab and into industry?
Sure. So there are many interesting use cases that people are exploring to see if they can gain some quantum advantage in their field. The kinds of the flavor of problems that I'll talk to you about in some detail is optimization problems. So optimize this problem with respect to these parameters and try to reduce something. For example, in chemistry, you're trying to optimize some parameter to reduce the energy of a molecule, for example. In banking, you might be trying to, for example, design a portfolio made up of different components and minimize risk or maximize profit. One way or another, the kind of flavor of problem that I'll be talking to you about is optimization. And so different industries are exploring how to map their specific problems onto a quantum computer. So these are early days. At IBM, we're really working toward what's called quantum advantage, which is to see an advantage in a practical use case from a quantum computer being involved in the work. So there's something called the IBM Q Network, which is a group of companies who have partnered with IBM to find use cases and to find quantum advantage in their specific use cases.
Can you tell me who is in the IBM Q Network and what they're using it for?
Sure, I can give you some examples. So a lot of the members of the Q Network have published their results, and I can tell you about some of these results because they highlight not just that companies are exploring quantum applications, but that also they're publishing research as a result of their work. So in just July of this year, for example, JP Morgan Chase published a research paper, and its title is Option Pricing Using Quantum Computers. And fundamentally, the kind of problem they're trying to solve is asking this question of, when you have several paths to a specific portfolio, when you have several options to how it could grow. So, you know, people do these forecasts where you predict where something could go. It might go one way or another. It might go up. It might go down. It might go somewhere in the middle. So the way you do the kinds of simulations of financial portfolios when you don't have an explicit formula for calculating how things would go is by doing what's called a Monte Carlo simulation. And traditionally, these Monte Carlo simulations, the way they work is by taking different snapshots of the data that you currently have and projecting those forward. And you get some bounds of where your portfolio could land, and then you make some estimates of some parameter, maybe profit. Well, in quantum computing, this research result shows that we can get some quadratic speedup over traditional Monte Carlo methods using what's called amplitude estimation. And so this is one of the quantum algorithms that they're using in their paper. So this gives you an idea of how a traditional problem of optimizing some sort of options pricing can be sped up, at least quadratically, using a quantum computer.
And then have you got any examples outside of finance?
Yeah, so maybe a little bit closer to chemistry, I can tell you about. So we have an IBM Q Hub at Keio University in Japan, and they recently published a paper on the archive called Computational Investigations of the Lithium Superoxide Dimer Rearrangement on Noisy Quantum Devices. And really, this is joint work between IBM and Mitsubishi Chemical. And the question here is figuring out how lithium batteries work and trying to understand how lithium oxide complexes can be used to make batteries that have longer, better performances and more efficiency. And at the end of the day, this is, again, reframing that question of taking a lithium oxygen complex into an optimization problem and solving that optimization problem on a quantum computer. So while the title of the paper sounds very long, again, it's a demonstration of how you're using a quantum computer to solve a chemistry problem. And this really goes back to the root of why quantum computing can be very useful. If you're going to simulate a molecule, which is inherently a quantum mechanical thing, instead of simulating it using a classical computer today, where you translate the problem into zeros and ones, it's better to use a quantum system that mimics the quantum molecule that you're trying to simulate. So here they're trying to show an advantage using quantum computers.
How much of an advantage have they shown?
So this is sort of laying the groundwork for the lithium oxygen complex research. It's not immediately obvious to me that there is quantum advantage, but the goal here is to explore how to map these problems in the first place onto a quantum computer. And once you do map them, the question becomes, how do you solve these problems and try to extract the results from a quantum computer and gain some meaningful insight?
So would it be fair to say that they're doing this for future research purposes, as in what they're doing now won't necessarily be of practical use, but when quantum computers are better, they'll have the skills, they'll have the languages, they'll have the techniques?
The way I would say it is, if you're trying to design a lithium air battery, and if you're trying to come up with different types of combinations of lithium and oxygen to give you some good performance on your some good performance with some metric, you can either build these systems, so you can go to a chemistry lab and form these different molecules and do the tests in lab, which is an inherently slow process, or you can simulate the properties that you're looking for on a computer, which tends to be much faster. And the goal here is to try to understand how to do this fast work on a quantum computer, how to test different molecules, simulate different molecules on a quantum computer.
Along with this, there must be a growing demand for developers that are on LinkedIn with quantum computing experience.
That's right. I think if you put the keyword quantum anywhere, it's sort of a hot field right now, and it's an exciting time to be in the field. There is a large demand for developers, and part of our education work is meant to address this large demand. You're not going to be able to build a developer community from scratch based on PhD students. PhDs just take too long to build a developer community. And this is why we're pushing very hard to integrate this to the undergraduate level and even below the undergraduate level. Just to give you an idea, a couple of weeks ago, I met with some students who were 14 years old in high school, who are excited about watching quantum computing videos online on YouTube and just consuming these videos and asking really hard questions that it really takes a while for me to try to think of the answers to give them. So think about how my training is entirely classical up to the point where I started my graduate work. But if you can get high schoolers to really think in a quantum mechanical way, to think about programming quantum computers from very early age, then it should be very easy to build a workforce from that foundation. So the idea is to push the education as close as possible to the undergraduate level.
Is IBM working with universities to get quantum computing into bachelor's degrees, undergraduate courses?
Yes. So at this very moment, there are several courses that have integrated the textbook into their coursework already. And I'm excited to hear. So the announcement about the textbook came in September, just in time for this fall semester. And I'm excited to hear the kind of feedback that we get from using the textbook in these courses. We are also excited not just to do coursework, but to provide internships to undergraduates. So, for example, this last summer, there was a very nice internship program between Princeton University and IBM, where students spent 4 weeks at Princeton and 4 weeks at IBM. And the idea here is they get to see both academic research and industry research in quantum computing, which is the kind of thing I wish was available when I was an undergraduate, because you really get to see the different challenges that industry and academia are trying to tackle.
Last time I spoke with Jay from IBM, I can't quite remember how many qubits you were at. And I know that's not necessarily the best measure, but it's an easy one. Where is IBM now with qubits?
We have a 53-qubit system online on the cloud right now. Clients have access to this device, and they've run over 14 million computations last I checked. So there's already a sizable amount of work being done on that system. The parameter that we look at that, so you hinted at this idea of number of qubits not being sufficient. The parameter that we like to look at is called quantum volume, and it tries to encompass not just number of qubits, but also things associated with the entire computation. For example, the quality of those qubits, how quickly do they decay? How complicated of a circuit can you simulate on these quantum computers? And so what we found is that we've been doubling the quantum volume roughly every year. And right now we are at a quantum volume of 16, if I can remember correctly. And so the goal is to increase this quantum volume to double it every year.
In the preparation for this, I can't remember if it was you or someone else was saying to me that even if we had a million qubits in a quantum computer, that doesn't necessarily mean we'd be able to use them or do something practical. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so two things come into this. One is if you have a million qubits, but they're not good quality qubits, then you're not going to be able to do anything meaningful on them, because it turns out the complicated circuits that we need to map complicated problems onto a quantum computer and solve it tend to require sort of what we call deep circuits, so several gates being applied on each qubit. And if your qubit is losing the quantum information in it very quickly before you're done with your computation, then there's no point to having a million of those qubits. The other thing to think about is translating a real-world problem. For example, how do I optimize a portfolio that is made up of these components and minimize, for example, risk or maximize profit? Whatever specific problem you're trying to solve, mapping that problem onto a quantum computer is not a trivial exercise. And so if I gave you a million qubits, a really good quantum computer with a million qubits, you need the workforce to be able to program that quantum computer. And that means you need the workforce that can translate the problems that you're trying to solve onto the quantum computer. And so it's not just an engineering challenge of getting really good quantum computers. That's a very hard problem. The other aspect of it is also building a community that can understand how to map problems from today onto these quantum computers. So it doesn't matter if it doesn't matter if we make quantum computers available unless we're building a community around using these quantum computers. And that's why I'm a member of the community team, for example, at IBM Quantum. And really what that's doing is building a community to explore use cases on these quantum computers, to get people to think more in quantum mechanics instead of classical mechanics, to see where you can extract advantage out of these quantum computers.
Are you saying, though, that it's harder to program against quantum? If I, let's say, went to a bachelor's degree in traditional computing and someone went to a bachelor's degree in quantum computing, one would be more difficult?
It's not hard to create a quantum program. It's just different from what we traditionally do. And that's what I was trying to hint at when I said these 14-year-olds who are seeing quantum mechanics. What I'm super excited about is seeing where that generation goes. In 10 years, they will be the ones developing on quantum computers for their jobs, and they will have built a foundation and solid understanding of quantum mechanics very early on. So it's not difficult, as you say. It just requires a bit of training to understand what you're looking for in a quantum computer. You're not trying to turn switches on and off. You're trying to take advantage of interference in quantum mechanics, for example.
We're recording this in late November 2019, and a few weeks back, there was a news story about either quantum supremacy or quantum advantage. Before we get into the news story, could you explain what that term, which is the right term, and what does it mean?
Sure. So this is one of these topics that on one aspect shows how far the field has come. We're at a very exciting time in this field. And if there's anything I saw from the news reports, it's how much excitement there is around this field. People try to come up with different ways to explain progress in this field. And one of the ways that you saw was this demonstration of quantum supremacy. So at IBM, we're looking for not just demonstration of a quantum computer for sort of a meaningless problem, but to find some quantum advantage in a problem where there is a real world use case. So I keep mentioning these examples of chemistry problems or portfolio optimization problems, designing new batteries and so on. All of this is to highlight the fact that we're trying to build quantum computers that will deliver real world results. And so at the end of the day, getting the field, moving the field forward from an engineering perspective is a hard task. And it's important that we celebrate achieving sort of victory over these engineering challenges, because this is a new field. But it's also important to remember that the end goal is to deliver some value to the real world in real world use cases.
How much of an advantage would you say a quantum computer would have to be considered supreme? So, you know, if I can program something on a powerful computer and it takes 10 minutes, is it really quantum advantage or quantum supremacy if the quantum computer can do it in 5 minutes? You know, twice as fast, great, but maybe it's a lot harder to program it. It's certainly going to be a lot harder to run it. There aren't very many of them around the world. You know, where is that line that you are supreme?
So see, this is why I think using the term supremacy, I mean, the term itself is problematic, but ignoring that aspect, this is why I think using the term supremacy is misleading. Quantum computers are not going to live and work entirely by themselves. They're going to work in union with classical computers. When I tell you I'm programming a quantum computer, really what I'm doing is taking my laptop, which is a classical computer, and writing code in Qiskit and interacting with the quantum computer. So really the way these quantum computers work is in union with a classical computer. So getting results back and forth between a classical computer and a quantum computer. So what we're looking for is speed ups in problems, but not for quantum computers to overtake classical computers. We're not going to have a quantum computer replace the computing chip in our iPhones, for example. So it's really important to keep this in mind, because what it highlights is that as quantum computers get more and more improved, we're also going to need improved requirements on our classical computers to work with these quantum computers. And it's not an end-all, be-all, build a quantum computer and have that be the only computing paradigm that we're looking at. It's looking for a situation where we can extract quantum advantage from both the quantum computer and classical computer working together.
It sounds like we're going to never be in a world where quantum computers are alone. It's always going to be a mix of classical and quantum. Can you give some more examples of that?
Sure. There is one of the more popular algorithms in this kind of work is called a variational quantum eigensolver. So let's just call it VQE for short. And the idea here is you're using a quantum computer for what it does best, which is to apply unitary operations. So you're using the best aspect of a quantum computer in combination with a classical computer. So the way it works is a classical computer tells a quantum computer, I want you to prepare this state, this quantum state, and operate on this quantum state. And I want you to tell me what the measurement outcomes are from working with that quantum state. And then a classical computer takes those measurement outcomes and looks at some sort of optimization problem. It says, was that answer closer to what I want or farther away from what I want? And then tells the quantum computer, okay, I need you to prepare this new state and give me the results for this new state. So you can see this is a classical computer and a quantum computer working at what they're both best at. The quantum computer does the manipulations of the quantum states, and the classical computer does the manipulation of the results from that quantum computer, which come out as classical results. So we're getting the best of both worlds here, and this is one of the successful algorithms that is being employed to do optimization type problems today.
When someone out there in the Q network or a person playing with Qiskit sends the job off to IBM, is there a single quantum computer, or do you have a rack of quantum computers, or how would you describe it?
This shows you just how much of an exciting time we are in. There are several quantum computers. I believe the latest number is 14 quantum computers available online. Some of them are available only to clients, and several of them are available for the public, so you might not see exactly 14. If you go to quantum-computing.ibm.com, you should be able to see the quantum computers that are available to you. When you send the job to a quantum computer, you're usually specifying which quantum computer you want to send the job to. And so you have this really nice situation where you don't just have one quantum computer and there's a public sort of flocking to it, but you have several quantum computers and you can choose which one to send the work to.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the book, where to get it, you know, if it's free?
Sure. So the open source textbook is available online on community.qiskit.org/education. One thing I'll point out is that in all of this education work, we've learned that people consume learning material in different ways. And a textbook is not necessarily the only way that people can learn about quantum computing. So we've also tried to put out YouTube videos about quantum computing. You'll also find those YouTube videos on community.qiskit.org/education. At the end of the day, I really want to see people taking advantage of the resources that we have available and coming up with exciting use cases. And maybe one thing to mention here is the open source textbook is anyone can contribute a chapter to this textbook. And to me, the most exciting thing is the most recent contribution comes from a 16-year-old who read a research paper from a quantum research group proposing a quantum algorithm and implemented that specific quantum algorithm on IBM's quantum computers, understood it well enough to write a chapter on the textbook about it and contributed it because it's open source. And see, this is the kind of thing that's exciting to see working in this field, is people coming into the field, gaining deep understanding of something and being able to contribute immediately, no matter what their age or background.
Any final notes before we wrap up for the day, Abe?
It's an exciting time to be in this field. If you don't know how to program a quantum computer yet, it's available online now. There's really no excuse not to learn. You have textbooks available to you. You have videos available to you. And we're excited to see your contributions in this field. So go to community.qiskit.org/education and access the quantum computers at quantum-computing.ibm.com.
If people wanted to follow you on Twitter, where would they go?
You can find me on Twitter at Abe_Asphalt, and Qiskit, the open source software, is at Qiskit on Twitter.
I'll put in links to all those things in the show notes. But Abe Asphalt, thank you very much for your time today.
Brian, thank you for having me.
I've made quite a few episodes about quantum computing. If you want to get a grounding in the basics of quantum computing, listen to number 68 with Michael Biersick. If you want to know more about IBM's effort, check out episodes 82 and 103 with Jay Gambetta. Or if you want to know about commercial quantum computing, check out episode 98 with Michael Brett. The opening music was Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Quantum by Shamil Elvenheim from the album Wormhole.